What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History at Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, my friend?
Chilling, man, as per usual. Round number two for us on recording.
Round number two. Yeah, we fucked up our intro before, so we're doing it again. I've been better, Danny. It seems like we're on the verge of WW3 again. So today it is Thursday, June 23rd. It is about 10:17 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And as we record this episode, there is a blockade in Europe. Well, maybe a more politically correct term would be called a quarantine.
It's a quarantine, kind of like what they did in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We just did an episode on this not too long ago, and this is part of the reason why we had to start the episode over, because we had to remember what the word was. Back then, JFK, when the Cuban Missile Crisis was starting to heat up, he decided to place an embargo around Cuba, but they didn't want to call it an embargo because an embargo would be tantamount to war. So they called it a quarantine, but everyone knew it was an embargo or a blockade. So tell me about this quarantine.
Yes. Well, Lithuania, they blocked the transit of sanctioned goods to Kaliningrad.
Okay.
Kaliningrad, if you look at a map of Europe, you'll see this confusing little area between Poland and Lithuania that's about 200 miles west of mainland Russia. It was an old port city captured from Germany by the Soviet Union during World War II. I don't really know too much about Kaliningrad, I'll be honest, so I won't speak like I do. However, right now there is a what Russia is calling a embargo. And what Lithuania is saying is legally abiding by just the recent EU sanctions. So Russia has to deliver everything to this little area, this little enclave in the western 200 miles west by rail transit. So all the supplies, all the gas, pretty much everything that they need comes from, the mainland, the heartland. So Lithuania has prevented the train transit from happening, and they're saying now that it's not an embargo because they're able to still receive some goods by the Baltic Sea.
Right, and just for some additional context, in case you're not staring at a map right now, Henry's talking about Kaliningrad, which is 200 miles west of mainland Russia. Now, it's situated between Kaliningrad and Russia, happens to be Lithuania, which is how and why this situation has arisen. Now, Lithuania is a part of the EU. Lithuania is claiming that it is, to Henry's earlier point, just following through with, these EU sanctions. Also, notably, Lithuania is one of those Baltic states that happens to be on the border of Russia that is in NATO, which makes this a particularly spicy situation. And I also just want to point out, Henry, Lithuania is, I guess, legal argument is that it's not an embargo because they can still get, access vis-a-vis the Baltic Sea. But if I remember correctly, the EU also blocked air travel over EU territory from Russian airlines, right? So they're not allowed to fly in EU airspace either. So they can't fly over Lithuania. They can't train through Lithuania, which leaves them with just one option, which is the Baltics. And that sea also happens to have two other nations that we talked about in our last episode, which is Sweden and Finland, who it seems like all but might join NATO. So if I'm Russia, feels a lot to me like a blockade or like an embargo.
Yeah, apparently the EU is trying to settle this and trying to walk this back. But today we're not actually going to talk about it. Yeah, that's what I think will happen. But we're going to talk about the Middle East again. Going back to our roots, when we primarily would speak about the Middle East frequently. But nowadays, and I guess this is a good thing in some weird way, that the Middle East is less violent than it used to be. At least it's less violent than 20 years ago after the Iraq War. It's less violent when we started podcasting, which is good. But I guess when we say it's less violent in a relative sense to Europe.
Yeah.
Because
which is a weird thing to say.
Scale modern war going on. Mm-hmm. However, I wanted to follow up on the conversation we were having about Turkey mainly. You know, we were speaking about the financial crisis in Turkey, about their crazy inflation rate, and how they're playing this kind of weird balancing game between the West and Russia in terms of what their geopolitical alignment is. We went over their obsession of sovereignty and not being some type of satellite state, despite being part of NATO. You know, they have very real interests that they pursue. Well, something interesting happened last week, or during this week, and it has to do with Saudi Arabia, which will be the topic of discussion for today. So MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, he visited Turkey for the first time since he whacked Jamal Khashoggi. You know, Jamal Khashoggi, the mm-hmm. former Washington Post columnist who got famous following bin Laden during the Soviet-Afghan War. Well, you know, the Saudis, a couple of years ago, in 2018 at this point, right? Yeah, 2018. Yep. And when I say the Saudis, I mean MBS specifically. They had him brutally murdered and dismembered into a bunch of pieces. And to this day, we never really got any answers on that. Exactly what happened there. Like, why did they just go batshit crazy with this man and kill him in such a grotesque fashion?
Man, he knew something.
We still don't really know why. And I'm sure we can open up a whole can of conspiracy theories here. But I'll just say assassinating a Washington Post journalist over, I mean, he was a critic of Saudi Arabia. Well, he wasn't a critic of Saudi Arabia. To be more specific, he was a critic of the new government, Mohammed bin Salman. You know, that was kind of the ire of his criticism. And, you know, he would criticize him over things that, you know, most Americans wouldn't really think about. So he would go after him over the blockade in Qatar and the crackdown on the Saudi royal family members, MBS's purges of like business leaders who weren't going along with a lot of the financial and economic reforms that he wanted them to cooperate with. He purged those people and put them in jail. Jamal Khashoggi was a critic of that, and he was a critic of that while in exile, essentially. And despite being just a critic of the government, I mean, every government leader has their critics and has journalists who kind of have a hard-on for them. It's still weirdly extreme to do what they did. Like, was this guy spoiling the Saudi PR campaign that MBS was a reformer that much? Because that was the campaign.
Right.
During that time period, 2016, 2017, when this guy first kind of arrived on the scene, when he was defense minister, when he became the crown prince, because it was like a huge deal that he was going to be this young future king. Most likely he'll become king in his either 30s or at the very oldest, early 40s. Most likely he's going to become king this year. The king is kind of frail and allegedly he has dementia and can't really do much. But he's going to be the king very soon. You know, it could happen, honestly, like you said, any day. Within the forecasting period, he'll most likely be king. The narrative was that this guy was going to kind of bring Saudi Arabia into the 21st century. And, you know, the women can drive thing was one of the top things that was sold to the West.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess he was kind of a reformer in those regards. But this guy, Jamal Khashoggi, was writing in the Washington Post. It's like, hey, liberals, don't trust this guy. He's taking some extreme measures. I still don't think that that he was spoiling the PR campaign that much for MBS that would have solicited that type of extreme reaction of brutally murdering him. So, for whatever reasons, MBS chose to kill him. I mean, it was barbaric, and it was especially barbaric to the U.S. political class, because, more importantly, Jamal Khashoggi was one of them. Well, the Turks are the ones who opened up the investigation on his murder. Erdogan was very hard on MBS. If someone's going to assassinate someone, it's going to be us. You have to remember Khashoggi is a Turkish last name. Khashoggi's grandfather was a doctor in the Ottoman Empire who became Ibn Saud, the original king of Saudi Arabia, or at least the original king of like the modern third kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the guy who kind of took it from being this tribe to a wealthy state. He was his personal doctor, and he relocated to the Gulf and then became this mega billionaire. So Khashoggi himself had connections to Turkey, both politically and then, you know, ethnically and, you know, through his own heritage. And besides the murder, at this time period, Saudi Arabia and Turkey were rivals to a degree. You know, they had different interests and they were taking different sides on different conflicts. They backed different factions in Libya. So that war that was taking place 3 years ago in Libya between the almost non-existent government that was mainly controlled by like the Muslim Brotherhood groups there. Turkey took that side, and then Saudi Arabia and then the Gulf, the other Gulf states, they all backed the secular strongman mustache Khalifa Haftar. The Turks were also had their own tensions previously with Saudi Arabia because Saudi blockaded Qatar, which is an ally of Turkey. So that even took place before the murder. Despite all this stuff, they've been trying to mend their relationships over the past couple of months. Erdogan was in Saudi Arabia just a few months ago. He was there in April, and he transferred the murder case back to Saudi Arabia, which is just a sign that, don't worry, we're over this. It's okay. It happened a long time ago. We'll transfer the murder investigation to you, meaning that they're transferring the murder investigation to nobody. But you have to understand, I think everyone knows why that there is this mending of relationships, and that's because of Turkey's financial crisis. Turkey is trying to attract Saudi investment funds as, you know, essentially a lifeline to pull themselves out of the economic problems that they're having.
Right. And we talked at length on our last episode about, you know, some of the economic woes that Turkey's having. So this play seems, you know, totally logical, at least from Erdogan's perspective. Let's try and start chatting it up with the folks that's got a lot of money. And maybe we can take this time to talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia's economy. And if you don't mind, Henry, I'd like to take this part. But the Saudi economy is without a doubt the largest in the Middle East. It's been dependent on oil for most of its history, but it's been on this quest to become more like the UAE through kind of this diversification play over the long term called Vision 2030. We've actually talked a lot about this on the show in the past. And they're using their sovereign wealth basically to fund crazy infrastructure projects. And they're really, really crazy. So they're putting heavy emphasis on building things for tourism development. And one of these projects is called the Red Sea Project. We've got a little bit on here. Let me just quote this here. It says, "The Red Sea Project will comprise 50 resorts on the country's pristine Red Sea coast, including some 8,000 hotel rooms and more than 1,000 residential properties across 22 islands and 6 inland sites. Complete with its own international airport, the scheme will include luxury marinas, golf courses, entertainment and leisure facilities. Work is on track to welcome the first guest by the end of 2022. There are already around 14,000 workers on site at the Red Sea project, a number that will increase between 30,000 and 35,000. Worried about the environmental effect of the excessive worker and plant traffic on the coast, TRSDC specified prefabrication techniques as much as possible. So it's an absolutely massive project, and this is just one of many things that is that falls under that Vision 2030 plan.
I mean, a lot of the things are kind of pipe dreams. They're not going to do. They're not going to commit to, I think it's like decarbonization by 2060. They're not going to obviously do that. They're ready to produce oil. They have enough in their oil reserves to at least produce at the same levels they're at right now. I think until like 2070. I think so.
Well, I think the pie in the sky idea for that is that they want to become carbon neutral, which doesn't necessarily preclude the sale or burning of fossil fuels. It just means they have to do other things to, you know, offset their carbon emissions. But given how Saudi Arabia has made their incredible wealth, oil, it's highly unlikely that they would have decarbonization or carbon offsetting to totally, you know, offset all of their carbon emissions. It just doesn't make any sense. They're entirely reliant on oil.
I guess they have the good sense to understand that they do have a lot of problems with diversification in their economy that has been masked by their GDP, which is a result of because of their oil production. They're trying to kind of mimic the success that UAE has had. It's going to be a harder task for Saudi Arabia. Did you hear about the city that they plan on building in the northwest called Neom?
Is that the like straight line city?
If you type in Neom in your Google search bar, and I encourage everyone, it looks like a future paradise. Like, oh, I went on the good timeline where Woodrow Wilson never became president.
There's a whole ass website on it. Looks pretty fancy. I'm going to read a quote that's on their about page from Joseph Bradley, who is Neom Technology and Digital CEO. And he says, Neom is not about building a smart city. It's about building the first cognitive city, where world-class technology is fueled with data and intelligence to interact seamlessly with its population, which is the most, like, they're trying to turn a city into a tech startup, basically, which I think is hilarious. And just kind of scrolling around a little bit on here, it looks like, you know, here's one way that they're trying to, you know, make themselves carbon neutral. They are planning an initiative to plant 100 million trees in Neom. So it's kind of a joke.
So going back to their economy, in the short term, things are looking pretty good for them. You know, they're getting a really big boom with the increase in oil prices. Back to the MBS visit to Turkey, it's sort of setting up the stage for the upcoming Biden visit to Saudi Arabia.
Oh, God. Is he going to put his hand on the globe just like Trump did?
I do not anticipate a theatric performance like when the Saudis greeted Donald Trump. I think it'll be pretty cold. I mean, it'll be polite and they'll do the handshakes and they'll smile and, you know, they'll be in front of the camera. But neither of them like each other at all. Biden hates MBS. MBS hates Biden. They strongly dislike each other. Biden has never liked Mohammed bin Salman. I think the Democrats in general, they look at him as kind of a Trump person, which they're kind of right about. Because I remember speaking with Gregory Gauss, who's the Dean of International Relations at Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. And he's a Saudi expert. He's a Saudi watcher. He's probably one of the top Saudi experts in the country. He said that, I asked him, like, how did MBS rise to power? And he said, You know what? I think a lot of it had to do with Jared Kushner and Donald Trump. I think that they identified them and they played their hands in the Saudi royal family. And I think that had to do a lot with him getting favor as the chosen successor. It's hard to believe because historically the Saudi royal family has been pretty close-handed in their succession process and, you know, how they kind of form their government to the U.S. But, you know, according to him, which I, you know, take as an authority, the Trump team was influential in him rising, you know, as the crown prince. And the political class in general really favored MBS's uncle, Bin Nayef, who had been the previous crown prince. I think everyone liked him. They saw him as kind of like a reliable status quo type partner. He was kind of the chosen successor, and they did not want this guy who was unpredictable, had allegiance to a political enemy in Trump, to become the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Now, Biden vowed to turn Saudi Arabia into a pariah state over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. He released the intelligence report linking MBS to the murder. So how about that? So he released the intelligence report that, you know, said that Mohammed bin Salman was guilty of this murder, which he had been denying, still denies.
It's going to be a really awkward meeting after that, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see Biden going to Saudi Arabia right after refusing to attend a summit with leaders of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, because he's not meeting with them because he's saying that they're, you know, dictatorships and ran by strongmans and autocracies or whatever you want to call them. They're not liberal democracies. I mean, you're meeting with the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. I mean, what other way would you describe that government?
Not to mention like his personal gripe or his personal detesting of Mohammed bin Salman himself. Like, okay, you know, the leaders of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, especially, you know, Venezuela, aren't necessarily friendly with the U.S., but I don't remember Biden calling out president of Venezuela the way that he's, you know, had a bit of an itch to call out MBS, you know? So it's kind of a weird thing, but I mean, there's an obvious reason why he's going to Saudi Arabia. It's super clear. And it's because of the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, the reason for the about face is yes, the war in Ukraine. You could say that Biden has found it necessary to court other energy producers to replace oil from Moscow. And ultimately, he wants to stabilize world markets. And OPEC has, you know, they recently pledged to increase their production into July and August. And I think the expectation is that these increases are going to go throughout the fall, even though they haven't pledged to increase past August. But I think that's what the expectation is that they're going to continue to ramp up production. Now, Blinken and the Biden foreign policy team and the State Department, when they're confronted about this is not the first administration to use this reasoning. It's kind of like the common talking point in Washington in general among just politicians and also the think tank community. They do it because of security, not necessarily oil. And, you know, they'll say, like, we don't actually import that much oil from Saudi Arabia. So why do you think this relationship is based solely on oil? This relationship is about security. And when they say security, they bring up two things. They bring up the partnership with Iran or the partnership with Saudi Arabia to be a bulwark against Iran. And then they talk about Saudi Arabia as a partner against terrorism,
which is such bullshit.
Which is complete bullshit because the Saudis are the number one sponsor of terror groups in the world. They've always have been. The U.S. has turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's support for jihadi terrorism and also just the overall spread of Wahhabism over the past four decades. Well, you can say, well, sometimes you have to sacrifice your values to your national interest. What Biden is doing is not really realism. It seems like he's just ultimately setting himself up to be, to look like an idiot, to be completely honest. If you were in the pursuit of lower oil prices, the easiest thing to do would be is to make a plan with Iran to get back into the Iran deal. And if you're going to go all in on Russia, which seems to be the policy right now, is to prolong the war and you know, kind of wait it out, and hopefully Russia runs out of steam and they have economic problems. Regardless, they're all in. Doesn't seem like there's going to be any type of normalization between the West and Russia anytime soon. So going back into the Iran deal would be the natural thing to happen if you wanted to ultimately help Europe reduce its dependency on Russian gas and oil. Iran has over 50 billion barrels of oil in storage that could go into the global market. All Biden would have to do is get back into the deal that his former administration made. Like, that's the deal that his boss made. So it's kind of silly when you think about it. I mean, there are fixes, even if you want to maintain this real hawkish policy on Russia, which the administration is committed to doing.
I mean, it's wild because, you know, there's no indication that just dumping more oil into production is going to make an immediate dent in say like gas prices. But it is kind of a virtue signal. It's also super weird because it's not going to go over very well with the right in general, because the right still has this boogeyman complex with Iran. And also, you know, a lot of the right just feels like we should just be drilling and, you know, increasing oil production domestically. So I'm not really sure how, like, does this satisfy the liberals? I mean, liberals don't even want oil, you know? And they certainly don't like, as you pointed out, they don't like the Saudis either, or specifically MBH. So I don't know if this oil play even makes a whole lot of sense. It sounds like they're just grasping straws for the midterm. See what wins could they get? It just doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
I think when gas prices are over $6 a gallon, everyone is hoping to find a way to reduce gas prices. No matter what your views are on climate change and decarbonization and renewables mm-hmm. are, if you're immediately doubling your commuting price, in some cases tripling your commute to work, I don't care how liberal you are, you're going to be like, "So why, man, not, we got to get some more oil in that market."
So then in that case, why not, you know, closer to home? Why not, like, look at Venezuela? Why not drill some more on our own turf? Like, and I'm not advocating for this, by the way. I think it's a terrible idea and we should totally, like, push towards more sustainable, like, green energy. But that's a different story. But what I'm saying is there's probably easier ways to get oil than to, you know, basically about face on Mohammed bin Salman, you know, because that's what he's doing out there. You know, the State Department tries to play like that. That's not going to be the case. But, you know, we know, everyone knows.
Well, here's the thing. Politically in the U.S., I don't think people really give a shit what we do to get our oil, as long as, you know, there's not a price shock. As long as if oil prices are down, or if oil per barrel is down and gas prices at the pump are lower, people are just going to be like, okay, great, and be happy. If gas prices are high, then that's just going to be a point of contention in politics. I don't think that the average American really thinks or cares about how we make these deals or what the geopolitical consequences are around them. So if he went and pissed off the right and they had some talking points about, oh, he's capitulating to Iran, all blah, 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 they're going to build nuclear weapons in 6 months, blah, 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 I think that would mostly just fall on deaf ears. It was just like the same thing with Democrats criticizing Trump for making peace with trying to make peace with North Korea. Oh, blah, 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 blah. How could you sell out to South Korea? How could you be friends with a dictator? No matter what you do, that your the rival political faction is going to be against it and criticize it and say that you're a traitor and all this. It is what it is. That's the name of politics.
What you're saying is that, like, the ends, politically, the ends justify the means. It doesn't matter, in the case of at least oil, it doesn't matter where we get the oil. As long as the oil prices go down, no one's really going to give a shit. And that's kind of a pessimistic way to look at it, but it's also probably pretty realistic. But again, you know, I mentioned this before, it's not going to make a huge dent.
And you have to think, and Biden's coalition of voters is more than just liberal housewives. It's a whole collection of, like, working class minorities and you know, different groups who are really impacted by higher gas prices. And gas prices don't just impact your commute to work. They impact everything. They increase the cost of transit and the cost of goods at your grocery store. They are a factor behind inflation. I mean, inflation is the printing of money or the overprinting of money, but they're definitely a contributing factor to the increase in prices that we're all can't help but see. You know, at Starbucks, I went to Starbucks and I got an iced coffee with almond milk, grande, which, first of all, it's bullshit how they fucking name their coffees.
Yeah, right. Grande, isn't that the small one? Or the medium one? I don't even remember. It's not the big one, because that's the venti, right?
That's the medium one. Grande is the medium. The large is venti. The small, you know what they call the small size?
Tall.
That's like just an Orwellian world to me right there. You call the small size tall.
Why not, like, well, pequeño or some shit like that? If we're going to go with, like, the Spanish or the Latin roots.
It was $6.25 for a grande iced coffee at Starbucks.
Wow, Henry, you're such a millennial, griping over Starbucks.
I mean, I'm not just griping about Starbucks, but that's a 50% increase in the cost of that coffee. I got that coffee a year ago for $3.25 or $3.50 or whatever with tax. Now it's six something. I don't know. That's crazy to me. That's nuts to me that the price went up that high for something I consume frequently. I drink coffee a lot. That's how this podcast is made. I chug coffee basically throughout the entire day. That's how I have the energy to do this. That's a lot of money for a single iced coffee that cost a couple of cents to make.
All right. So do you want me to get you one of those stickers that said, I did that with Biden's face on it, and we can put it on all your coffees from now on?
What's that sticker from?
Oh, you've never seen that? Like, Google it real quick. It's like a kind of annoying meme. It's like a sticker that people are putting on the gas pumps with, like, Biden, and said, I did that.
Let's just be real. The inflation has been caused by the money printing during COVID. That's why there's so much inflation going on right now. It's not all because of Joe Biden. I mean, they're trying, and they're honestly probably going to do this successfully just because of the timing of the presidency.
Of course.
He kind of did get stuck in. Joe Biden, for all of his horrible faults, he did kind of get stuck holding the bag. And it's not like he was doing anything to make it better. I'm not saying that. He did get stuck with, like, the recession bag. Here you go. Like, hot potato, hot potato. Oh, you got the recession. Ha ha. You got the inflationary recession. Sorry. It is what it is. That's just monetary policy. Someone's got to get stuck with this bag every decade, every 15 years, every decade. And that's what it is. So, yeah, of course, Republicans are going to use that to their advantage. They wouldn't be doing their job if they weren't. Back to, we got completely off topic on this one. I think Biden is going to Saudi Arabia, or at least one of the things on his mind right now is not necessarily about the increase in oil production. I think that maybe some of his political strategists are saying, hey, we need some type of win to take back home with us. Why don't we go there and you know, we're working on this roadmap for normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Why not we try to like iron out a plan and say we got Saudi Arabia and Israel to normalize each other and become friends and neighbors? Because the average American thinks that all Arabs are the same.
So, such a joke. Can we go back to the oil thing?
I'm not making this up. I hear you, dude.
I'm just saying, like, Biden's going to go out there and try to make peace in the Middle East. That you might as well shoot for the more reasonable one of, like, let's get some more oil, because that's a silly, silly objective.
Well, and Trump did the same thing. Trump did the same thing last a couple of years ago with the Abraham Accords. Basically, right. They're like, I created peace in the Middle East. Right. I got
such a meme. It's not real. I know. Real.
He got Middle Eastern countries that already have good relationships with Israel to recognize Israel formally. And they're like, I stopped decades of war in the Middle East by doing this. No, these countries already had good relationships. And that's the same thing with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Saudi Arabia and Israel have been cooperating on security issues for the past three decades. In fact, it goes pretty much since both of their existences, they've been on the same side almost every single geopolitical event or geopolitical interest. They've always been on the same side. They've always cooperated with each other. They've always been tacit allies. They don't recognize each other. There is a political risk for governments to recognize Israel because, by and large, most Arab populations do not like Israel. So it's hard to – there's a risk in doing that, but the governments cooperate. So working out a plan – and the Saudis have already said, like, they're committed to doing it. The Israelis are saying, why not? Like, why don't we just officially normalize our relationships? And then you can just go back and say, oh, this Joe Biden's experience, he got the Arabs and the Jews to finally like each other. What a whiz.
So fucking ridiculous.
I do think there's an element of that. Like, why not try to just sell a piece? Why don't we just try to kind of propagandize our way out of the crises that we're in right now? And try to just make up a Middle Eastern peace deal out of nowhere.
It's not going to work. I mean, like, it's obviously, to the reasons that you just pointed out, they're already working together. So this would just be fucking, you know, making it going from friends with benefits to just straight up in a relationship. I get that. I understand. What I'm trying to say is that I don't see this as being, like, fruitful at home. You know, I don't see all the Americans being like, yeah, great. Joe Biden's awesome. He made peace in the Middle East. No, they're going to be like, my fucking gas is still $6 a gallon. I don't give a shit.
Well, what did the famous James Carville say? He's still alive, so I shouldn't speak about him as he's dead. James Carville is a famous liberal Democrat pundit.
Okay.
But he's not like a newer school one. He's more of a guy who rose up in the 1990s during the Clinton age. So like his rivals and the people he went after were like Newt Gingrich and you know, those Republicans from the 90s and 2000s.
Mm-hmm. What did he say?
But he said, it's the economy, stupid.
Ah, he said that?
The economy, stupid. That's
smart
his
man.
Famous words. It's the economy, stupid. And that's really, I think, what it comes down to. And when you see political shocks like we did see in 2016, it's the economy. It's that there's large inequities in wealth, and people are upset about that. So I don't think most people give a crap about – unless you're in a position like George W. Bush was after the Iraq War, where you get a blank check to do whatever foreign war that you want because we just went through a horrible, tragic event in 9/11. People are going to like be like, yeah, I want to – but as it goes on, people are going to be like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, people are finally saying that the war is causing problems here and we should keep on doing that. I don't know about doing that anymore. I think we should stop. And I think that's going to be the eventual reaction of most Americans.
If Biden really wants a win, he gets Saudi Arabia to stop bombing the shit out of Yemen. That's a win. Because this whole weird, like, let's normalize relationship between, you know, Israel and Saudi Arabia, not only is it just superficial on the face of it, but also I frankly don't think people would care. And since it's not really anything of merit, it's kind, I mean, peace is always a good thing, but it's just kind of a waste of time. He should, if he's going to do anything on peace in the Middle East, he should focus on like stopping the war in Yemen. I think you should give him a straight up ultimatum and be like, yo, we're not sending you any more guns, no more bombs. You're going to stop doing what you're doing. Straight up. So maybe we just turn to Yemen for a bit.
Yeah. So first and foremost, just one thing, just to one more thing. The Middle East, the United States is de-escalating in the Middle East. I mean, that's just been a trend since the Trump years. And to include the greater Middle East, so Central Asia, I think most people by now kind of throw Afghanistan into the MENA countries, even though, you know, it's not, but it effectively kind of is, same theater of war, essentially, where there is this big de-escalation from these ridiculous nation-building type projects in Afghanistan. And, you know, military thinkers are more or less thinking about, you know, Asia and Russia and larger geopolitical foes rather than, you know, these smaller countries in North Africa, in the Middle East. Now, this is forcing, and this could be, I think, a larger thought in the foreign policy establishment among realists, that there's going to be a natural, with the de-escalation of the Middle East or U.S. presence in the Middle East, they are going to, like, the Israelis and the Arabs are going to have to cooperate and work with each other, because all of them are going to want to, because they're all small states. When you think about it, Israel has 10 million people. The other Gulf states have, like, I think Saudi Arabia is probably the biggest with around 30 million people or so. These are all countries that are significantly smaller than the two historic powers in the region. The two historic powers in the region are the Turks and the Persians. They're the ones who used to be bitter rivals. They're the ones who used to be the, you know, historical rulers for a very long time. And I think that, I mean, both those countries have populations of, I think Turkey probably has a population of around 80 million people, and then the Iran has to have close to 100 million people. But they, you know, they're large countries, and they're serious geopolitical foes, especially for the Israelis and the Saudis. Now, I think that the progression is that there's going to be more cooperation between the Israelis and the other, especially Gulf Arab states, in forming security alliances against mainly Iran, but I mean, it could possibly mean really anyone. I think part of this normalization plan that the White House is talking about is going to include, I think, a missile deal between Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, where they're working on like a missile defense program. So I think maybe the State Department, that might be one of the big things that Biden is going to talk about, maybe just overseeing the natural kind of events that are going to take with the transition of the U.S. Out of the Middle East. So that could be it, rather than just the political win. My inner cynic is saying that, which maybe my inner cynic will be proven right, that this could be like a way to present a win to the base.
I mean, so what you're saying is that because the U.S. is pulling out of the Middle East broadly, that because we're not going to be in there fucking around anymore, all the
actors and players in that region has to now, you know, band together to thwart Iran or, I don't know, potentially Turkey or other larger regional actors. So you're saying that is a natural progression, and somehow Biden wants to go over to Saudi Arabia to facilitate that, and that becomes the political win?
I don't think that's gonna how it will be pitched to the public, but that's definitely, I think that will be one of the highlights of conversations. It's like, hey, like, how's everyone getting along over here? Because the Israelis and the Arabs and the Arab Gulf states are, you know, again, they've been cooperating for a very long time. But I think that their security architecture will become more recognized as like a formal entity, rather than it be like, you know, the Mossad and the Saudi secret police or having, you know, tacit ties. It will be more.
So
it will
be
more
formal. Middle East NATO alliances. Over there, like
no, I don't think they're gonna make a Middle East NATO, but they're gonna have kind of like joint deals. They'll have probably like, you know, different projects. Maybe they'll go as far as like training exercises. Who knows? But I think you're gonna see more cooperation between those states, and I think that's just the next step of the U.S. leaving.
But like, so why is it a, that why could is be, it a good idea to give Saudi Arabia more access to dangerous weapons, like missile programs, as an example? Why is that a good idea? We know what they're going to use it for, which again, Yemen.
Well, let's turn to Yemen, because things have actually been better in Yemen. I mean, I'm saying better as in compared to a year ago at this time. So Hadi, and first and foremost, there's been a ceasefire that has been renewed. So there was a ceasefire that started in April. It was renewed at the beginning of June. I think most people following the war, or at least the people that I've read, and a lot of experts on Yemen and Saudi Arabia that I've read, were surprised that this was renewed. They were like, oh, wow, this is unexpected, but I'll take it type of attitude. So there was a ceasefire. So the fake president of Yemen, Hadi, so the guy who ran for president in 2014 with one man on the ballot, where you can, you know, find this one guy on the ballot, Hadi,
somehow got less than 100% of the vote.
Yeah. So when Saleh got injured in that assassination attempt, Hillary Clinton basically just kind of installed him as president of Yemen. And this guy was hated. This guy was exiled. And he was called the government of Yemen, but he was just some guy in a hotel room in Riyadh. And he was the government of Yemen. So he officially stepped down as president of Yemen, and he handed over his rule to like a collection of like tribal groups. The tribal groups there have like a leadership council. So he's gone from the picture. So I guess there's at least not the facade that there's a Yemen government fight. It's, you know, at least that obstacle is gone. And on the other side, you know, in addition to the ceasefire, politically in Congress, this is an issue that I guess there is will from the House to fight this, just because it's the war. So I guess if enough people get in the face of Bernie Sanders, and I think Bernie Sanders has been actually really good on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if enough people get into the face of their congressmen or their elected officials, and they're like, hey, this is, if you show them like starving, because it's very easy to just type Yemen and starving children, and you'll see these horrific pictures that,
right,
if you are presented these pictures and you're not like, oh my God, there's policy changes we can make to prevent this from happening, you have to be a sick sociopath. So ending the war in Yemen is not really controversial in Congress.
Good.
To the point where I think that in order to want to back the war or continue the war, you have to have like a very direct political or business interest not to oppose it, or you have to be just totally drunk on the Kool-Aid that Iran is like secretly running the war. Like, oh, it's all Iran and everything's an Iranian proxy and we have to fight them there, or Iran is going to take over all of the Middle East. I think that if you drink that Kool-Aid, like a Nikki Haley type person,
right,
who's crazy. But if you're a somewhat reasonable liberal hawk, I mean, even the neoconservatives, I bet you can get them in a room and say, okay, we need to get this to stop. I bet you can get like Bill Kristol to say, all right, it's time to end this.
Enough
is enough. Mm-hmm. Like the most hawkish liberal crazies, I think you could get to support this. It's more of just like an anti-Iran thing at this point, the ones who want to continue it. Like, oh, we can't let Iran get a foothold in the Gulf. With Iran, there'll be a direct threat to Israel. Trump was someone who had that crazy mentality where, you know, everything was a threat to Israel. And he also, again, going back to earlier, MBS and Trump had connections.
Business connections,
political connections. I think the Trump administration valued the leadership in Saudi Arabia as loyal allies as you can have on the international stage, and they wanted to keep them happy. And also, there was the arms deals that he kept on bragging about. That
mm-hmm. Hey, we're going to sell billions of dollars in weapons. Yeah. We're gonna make
I think he was genuinely confused about them. I don't really think he knew understood how the arms deals worked, but he vetoed it four times in total. Those was the SJ Resolution 7, which was early in 2019, which was the first time it was ever used. The Wars Powers Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time that it was ever used. But I mean, hopefully that this ceasefire continues to hold up, and you know, this resolution is passed that to end any support and kind of build off the momentum of the continued ceasefire, because it also seems that the Saudis do want out of it.
Why? Because they're not immediately winning.
It's just the war's never going to end. The war will never end unless there is some type of negotiated solution where you satisfy the different tribal elements in the war. It's just not going to end. There's enough weapons. There's enough guns. There's enough pissed off people with dead family members who are willing to grab rifles and fight, and the war will not end. So Saudi Arabia can do the same thing that Egypt did in the 1950s or 1960s, excuse me, and just blow their wad on Yemen, because that's ultimately what destroyed Egypt in the 1960s. They blew their wad all on Yemen, and they basically just made it really easy for Israel to just smoke them. So they want to do all these crazy projects. If they had this prolonged war forever, because that's how long it will be, the war will just go on forever, then good luck. Like, you want to always have the risk. And now the Houthis have like ballistic missiles and shit like that. Why are you going to just keep on, like, every year it seems like their ability to strike Saudi infrastructure increases. Just, it's not that big of an interest for them, really. Like, just a couple of better ports to have access to, like, that's what we're fighting over. It's crazy. I think it's just a lack of the leadership. I think one of their princes who dealt with like the patronage network in Saudi Arabia died. I think that was one of the big reasons why the Saudis lost control over their Yemen policy. I don't know. Maybe it's worth just going over the history of this real quick.
Sure, yeah. Let's talk about it.
So Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And to make a long story short, Yemen has really been in a perpetual war for decades. The most recent war is the war that started in 2014. And the war in 2014 has created the world's largest humanitarian crisis. So hundreds of thousands of people have died. The most recent estimate is about 400,000 people have died. Most of these have, these casualties or most of these deaths are due to things like starvation and you know, death to treatable diseases.
Cholera.
Cholera. It's a real tragedy. It's really awful. And Yemen is... it's a state in name only. It's not really much of a state at all. It's hard to call it a nation state. It's dominated by indigenous tribes who control different parts of the country. The southern tribes are primarily Sunni, and the northern tribes are mostly Zaydi Shiite. Zaydi Shiite, they're very different from Twelver Shiites in Iran. They have their own thing. They're actually closer to Sunnis in a lot of ways, but they have their own. It's kind of a very fringish sect that's really only native to that part of the Arab world. So these political factions, they clash in this city called Sana, which is the largest city in Yemen. It's also the center of the country. And, you know, it's a complicated affair because we're dealing with the many different tribes of Yemen. So tribal politics. To give you some historical context, in the 1800s, northern Yemen, so this used to be different part, Yemen was divided into different regions. Northern Yemen was part of the Ottoman Empire, and southern Yemen was part of the British Empire. The British used Aden as a refueling point for ships traveling through the Suez Canal. So Aden's on the Red Sea, so it's a natural port when traveling through the Suez Canal in Egypt. After World War I, when the Turks left the Arabian Peninsula, northern Yemen gained its independence, and then it also became a monarchy. Southern Yemen, it remained occupied by the British until the late 1960s. And after World War II, when the British and the French started to, you know, leave these areas, when they started to ditch their empires, essentially, what rose in place of empire in the Middle East was a ideology called Pan-Arabism. And, you know, Pan-Arabism is kind of that Arab nationalism. It was greatly instigated by or largely spread or influenced by a Egyptian colonel named Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he overthrew a unpopular puppet king in Egypt. And Nasser, he drafts up a socialist constitution. He starts to nationalize the economy. And after that, Pan-Arabism starts to spread throughout the Middle East. Now, the British don't like this. They especially get upset when Nasser, or the Egypt, they nationalize the Suez Canal in order to, you know, fund their different infrastructure projects, the main one being the Aswan Dam in Egypt. And now, one of these countries that, and the reason why I bring this up is that Pan-Arabism spreads to northern Yemen. In 1962, there was a Nasserist military coup in North Yemen, which created a very large civil war that lasted about a decade. And then the Nasserists were backed by Egypt. They joined and they intervened on behalf of the government in the north. It became a disaster for them. They were there for 8 years in total. They lost tens of thousands of soldiers fighting a guerrilla insurgency. And the south was backed by the a combination of Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States and the British. So it's I think most people are so binary where they think that Arab equals one side, Israelis on the other side, constant warfare. In fact, the Israelis and the Arabs, or and the Israelis and the Saudis, are virtually on the side of almost every major conflict that you can really think of.
And this just happened to be one of them.
So this is going back to the 1960s. Israel's main enemy has always been Arab nationalist rather than the religious countries or the Wahhabist countries or the monarchies there. It's always been the spread of Arab nationalism. Now, when the British leave southern Yemen in 1967, the southern Yemen reorients. It becomes basically it becomes allied with the Soviet Union. So you have these two states in Yemen, YAR, the Yemen Arab Republic, at the north, and then the PDRY, the People's Republic Yemen, in the south. And then these two Yemens have border clashes for years upon years. Sometimes they have periods of cordial relationships. And they eventually agree to merge in 1990 with the president of North Yemen, Ali Abdel Salah, becoming president of this new state. And it's important to note that North Yemen had all the major population centers, and South Yemen is all desert, except for the city of Aden, that's in South Yemen, which is right, more or less in the central. But the key person you need to know who kind of runs things in Yemen for many years is Salah. Salah was a military commander who came to power in 1978 after the previous president was assassinated. And he's a guy who came from a lower level tribe. He was he was a commander of like a local military district, but he understands how to create these complex political patronage systems, which is key to kind of holding the power in Yemen, is having access to the political the tribal patronage system. And that really becomes the core framework of the government, or what becomes the eventual state of Yemen. So, he understood how to extend this patronage network to satisfy those local tribal leaders, to make them, cooperate with the state power. Because I guess there's a pretty red line, and it's pretty easy to kind of cross those red lines to piss off these tribal leaders and to get yourself back into, some type of war. So he essentially creates a modern state through his, connections. Then the Houthis, they come to be. So the Houthis, they originate in northern Yemen. They consider themselves the descendants of Muhammad. They, they're Zaydi Shia, and they're I don't want to get into the different religious differences because I'm going to make this too long, but they're significantly different than the Shia in Iran or the Shia in Iraq. Like the most of the Shia, they have significant theological differences with them. Regardless, they are they've kind of been forced to ally with Iran. And I guess the best way to put it is that the Zaydi, or the Houthis, who are predominantly Zaydi, they've been kind of pushed. They're fighting this war with Saudi, and Iran basically said, hey, you're fighting Saudi, we'll help you. And then that was it. Like, I think that was kind of how that relationship was formed. It was that nothing to do with like the extension of like I don't think there was any religious element whatsoever between the Iranians and the Shia. Not like there was in Iraq. In Iraq, there's definitely a huge religious element to that, where you know they share, you know, similar Ayatollahs and stuff like that. But there was not that camaraderie between Zaydi Shia and the Twelver Shia there. Maybe it's developed, but from what I've read, that just never really existed. It was purely a geopolitical relationship. But I think it's important to understand when America gets into the picture. In 2009, when Obama became president, he told the CIA to drone war, to drone strike Al-Qaeda in Somalia, Pakistan, and Yemen. Al-Qaeda's Yemeni franchise had been blamed for the underpants bomber.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
So, and then also like FedEx bombing attempts. So in response, in 2009, Obama's like, all right, let's release the drones. Go after Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So Saleh takes the guns and the money, and then he starts to go after these Houthi rebels. What happens in response is the Houthis only end up getting bigger. He ends up getting blowback from attacking the Houthis. And, you know, when the Arab Spring starts to sweep across the Middle East, you know, Yemen didn't, Yemen was swept in that as well. There was an assassination attempt on Saleh. He ends up getting hurt. He survives he gets his face blown off, essentially.
Right, I was like just going to say, it's not off. Just that he got hurt. Dude was missing a face.
Yeah. His face was melted off in a car bombing, and he is forced to leave the country on medical to receive medical attention. And while he's there, Hillary Clinton just decides that he resigned and then runs an election that she claims is like a shining example of a democracy with one person on the ballot. And this is Hadi, the guy who I had mentioned who just stepped down. And the problem is that Hadi is very unpopular. He's a doofus. Hadi's just a dumb, he's a big, stupid idiot. He's not popular, and he just cannot handle creating the same. What's impressive about Saleh is that he's kind of holding on to this extremely complicated tribal network, and he's, for the most part, not allowing a full-scale war to break out. I mean, there are wars but in that time period, but he's somehow able to kind of manage just this network. And the Saudis were able to cooperate and deal with this network as well. And that's why, you know, they weren't drawn into the conflict. But the M. Night Shyamalan twist is that when Saleh wakes up from his injuries, he's a Zaydi Shia. So he's a Zaydi all along. So he's like, okay, I'm not going to fight the Houthis anymore. I'm going to join the Houthis. So he marches his army and he joins the Houthis. And then they combine their army to conquer to march down to the capital, Sana'a, and conquer it. And that's how the war breaks out. And the Saudis were on the side of the government.
The government, quote unquote.
The government meeting the guy. The government meeting the guy in a hotel room in Riyadh, and the war has been managed by U.S. war planners for many years, to the point where there are F-35s bombing people from high altitude. And you know, I don't know if this is true or not. This is completely alleged, but I kind of believe it, that there's U.S. pilots with Saudi pilots in those planes. So, again, that's a legend. Don't take that. That is just here. I heard. But that's where it is.
Yeah,
good developments though so far.
Let's maybe stop that. You know,
it's high time. If it's true that we're pulling out of these Middle East conflicts and we're winding it down, the only thing I would accept out of this Biden visit to Saudi Arabia as a positive thing is if he says, all right, you guys got to normalize relations with Israel because we're pulling out, and that means we're not going to manage your war against Yemen, and we know that you don't even want to be fighting in Yemen anyway. You know, it's not good for you. So we're just going to stop. So maybe they declare an end to the war, or shit, I'd be super happy if this is a surprise, like, you know, peace agreement between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, or, you know, the tribes of Yemen, whatever you want to call Yemen at this point, you know, that would be acceptable for me.
I mean, we're talking about the new leaders of Yemen are a council of like 9 village elders.
Right.
From different tribes and parts of the country. Come on. We don't, that's just beyond our ability to understand and manage and get and build off. Like, we just can't take that and be like, okay, this is something that we can go in and understand. That's just impossible. Like, this is something that needs to be sorted out in that region, and the U.S. should not be picking any sides. And Saudi Arabia shouldn't be picking any sides either. I mean, I understand if Saudi has national security interests and things like that, and they want to, if they're being attacked. But the reason why they are attacked by the Houthis, but the reason why they're attacked by the Houthis is because of their indiscriminate bombing.
Right. And they started.
It's their own blowback that right. They're, it's not because Iran is like running this super secret proxy war. Iran is just using it as a means to hit, because everyone knows Iran does have an extensive proxy network. They do have that's like one of their strengths, is that being able to get on the ground and develop relationships and camaraderie with like Hezbollah and stuff like that, and really make strong proxies. And every once in a while, the Houthis will say stuff that's really dumb, which will like make the entire... Oh, I should also add, Biden took the Houthis off the terrorism list. So that's a sign.
Was that recently?
That was, I think, like, not recently. It happened a while ago. I forget which month it happened. But he did take them off, which is just further signs where it's
like... That's big news.
Enough of this.
You should have just led with that. No, I mean, enough. Look at this. Like, if you're having trouble, like, following this Saudi Arabia Yemen war, or you're having trouble relating to it because, you know, it's not Ukraine right now, just think of it this way. There's a lot of blowback that's involved.
There's a big country and a small country.
There's a big country and
Saudi
a small
Arabia
country.
Is a big country, and right. Yemen is a small country. Well, right. The big country invaded the small country.
That's right.
In the words of our vice president when explaining the war
in Russia. But I mean, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, especially with the involvement of Iran, right? So Iran, you know, helping the Houthis is kind of like, you know, helping out Ukraine just to bleed, you know, Russia dry. Like, of course Iran's going to want to throw them a bone here and there, because if they keep up the war, then it weakens Saudi Arabia, and they don't like Saudi Arabia. Just plain and simple.
We're not throwing Ukraine a bone. We're throwing them the full cow.
Right.
Well, we're throwing
them the box of... Iran doesn't have the ability to do what we can do.
We're throwing them a box of Oreo cookies that will eventually kill them at the end. It may taste good, but it will eventually kill you.
It's just, you know, like, obviously war in Ukraine is terrible, and war in Yemen is also fucking terrible. And, you know, it's just all of it needs to stop. Literally all of it. So yes. I'll be happily elated to, well, I suppose I can't vote for Joe Biden anymore, can't I? I'm in Puerto Rico. Oh, well, if I could vote and he stops the war in Yemen, that would be one of the reasons why I would vote for him.
All right. Well, stay in Puerto Rico with your liberal politics. All right. all right. Let's end this thing.
Peace.
All right. Peace, everyone. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Bro History. We very much appreciate your time that you give us. Please rate and review the podcast. We're trying to get our ratings up. We're trying to get the reviews up. We are planning on doing an episode where we read the reviews. So we got plenty of nasty ones. So how about some nice ones for a change, right?
The nasty ones will be funny to talk about.
The nasty ones are fun as well, but you know, little diversity.
Just be more specific.
We can hear if you like the show. You can review the show and let us know. We like positive feedback as well. All right, so rate and review the podcast. That is the number one way to support our show. It helps our algorithm and us to be searched. So it's important that you guys do that. And we will see you next week with some more groundbreaking content. Oh, yeah, we also have a Patreon. You can join that as well, get access to our Slack. But we will be back next week. We are working on a history episode on the Spanish-American War that we've been working on for a while. And I'm not sure when we're going to record that one, if it's going to be next week or the following week, but should be exciting. Okay. Peace.
Peace.